My name is Tom Witt. The name of the session is The Death Penalty in the United States, Justified Punishment or Unnecessary Killing. My background for doing this session is not other than that I'm interested in it. First became interested in the death penalty as a student of American Studies at St. Olaf College, and more recently as a coordinator of the Lutheran Peace Fellowship, which is based in St. Paul. And most of my work is in the area of the peace question, the arms race, war and peace, but I see the death penalty, and I hope you will also see the death penalty as a related issue by the end of the hour, although I won't be specifically talking about the arms race. What I want to do in this session is just to share with you some information that I have on the death penalty and give ample time then for some discussion. But first of all, some background and development information, and to ask the question, why study the death penalty at all as we sit here and give the death penalty to flies all day long? In our history as a country, there have been an estimated 18,000 to 20,000 people lawfully put to death. About 7,000 of those have been since 1900. Probably an equal number have been sentenced to death, but for some reason spared. And lynching, which we must say is a uniquely North American phenomenon, has probably claimed about half as many deaths, 9 to 10,000. Right now in this country, there are about 1,400 people, 1,400 Americans under the death sentences in 31 states, and 7 others, plus the United States federal government, has one or more death penalty statutes in force. So 31 states have people that are sentenced to death, and 7 other states have death penalty statutes, but no one currently is under the death penalty. So we can't say that the death penalty is simply a vestige of the past, but it's very much with us. And again, as you might have heard in the announcement, since the late 1960s, American public has professed support, increasing support for the death penalty, and the latest figures are 70 to 80% of the American public now is in favor of the death penalty. The most recent poll that I read was over 80%. And that is contrasted with the mid-1960s when the pros and cons were more equally divided. And the question is why? And that will be our discussion, but I'd like for us first to be informed a little bit about capital punishment in the United States and some of the developments and the specifics of capital punishment. So I'm going to go through these 7 items, and I hope that gives us a good background as to where we've come from. Throughout history, there has been a long-standing struggle between those who would retain capital punishment and those who would like to abolish it. And there have been many developments then coming out of that struggle, which I won't fully explain, but there are some differences now in the way we treat capital offenders. And the first I want to talk about is inventing degrees of murder. I'll go through these fairly quickly. Inventing degrees of murder. Already by the 18th century in this country, murder can be distinguished into crimes of varying degrees. Murder is no longer just murder, but there are different kinds. Voluntary, involuntary, manslaughter, excused, justified, etc. Of course, first-degree murder we call the worst, which shows a willfulness, a deliberateness, and premeditation. Now, there originally were some objections to making that kind of distinction. An example of an objection would be someone who is impulsive and kills may be even more a menace to society than, for instance, the lonely, frightened wife who plots the death of her violent husband, for instance. But regardless, we do have these distinctions now in first-degree murder we call the worst. Secondly, reducing the variety of capital crimes. First execution in America was in the year 1630. At that time, there were 12 capital crimes, including, I'll read them, idolatry, witchcraft, blasphemy, murder, manslaughter, poisoning, bestiality, sodomy, adultery, man-stealing. I'm not sure whether woman-stealing was included in that or not. False witness in a capital trial, and rebellion. And each of these crimes was accompanied in the statute with a text from the Old Testament as its authority. Before 1700, then, rape and arson and treason were added to the list of capital crimes without biblical justification. The one exception, by the way, was Pennsylvania, a Quaker country, which before 1700 had no crime that was punishable by death. And then after 1700, I think it was only murder and treason after that. More recently, you will still see a variety of capital offenses, but you really find a disparity between the number of crimes subject to the death penalty and the very small number for which people are actually executed. Between 1930 and 1980, there were executions for only 8 different types of crimes. Murder, rape, armed robbery, kidnapping, sabotage, espionage, burglary, and aggravated assault by a lifetime prisoner. There are a few surprise categories that I was not aware of. People in this country have actually been executed for. For example, in Virginia, using a machine gun or shotgun in the course of committing a crime. In Alabama, exploding dynamite near any boat with persons aboard. That was on their books for a while. And until recently in Georgia, it was a capital crime to desecrate a grave. But this variety of offenses now, capital offenses, it has now ended due to a series of Supreme Court rulings against the death penalties during the 1970s, in which the court first nullified all non-mandatory death penalty statutes in a court case called Furman v. Georgia. That's the most important court case that people refer to. That was in 1972. All non-mandatory death penalty statutes were annulled. And later in 1976, all mandatory death penalty statutes were abolished. And what this did was to force each state to start from a clean slate and erase their statutes and think through exactly which crimes they wanted punishable by death, if any. And before that, the problem was that there was no real standard by which someone could be executed. And there was evidence that the death penalty had been inflicted in a wanton manner, arbitrarily, without any real consistency. So that was the reason for the Supreme Court cases in the 1970s. The third point is giving the jury's sentencing discretion. Traditionally, the death penalty was mandatory for certain crimes, but slowly mandatory death penalty statutes were replaced by discretionary laws. And in some ways, that was seen as a victory for those who would want to abolish the death penalty altogether. But in other instances, especially in the South, led to widespread abuse of capital punishment because it could be imposed arbitrarily or discriminatorily. In fact, it was so bad that there were 14 states during the 1970s that actually went back to mandatory death penalty statutes because the abuses were so bad. People were being executed for arbitrary reasons. But in 1976, as I said, all mandatory death penalty statutes were abolished, so there can no longer be that kind of law in any state. The Supreme Court said states must avoid what they called unguided discretion. Okay, fourth, the ending of public executions. Again, traditionally executions were arranged before hundreds or thousands of people so that they could watch the ritual. And the chief argument for this was it was the best way to maximize the deterrent effect. If you're going to have a death penalty statute on the books, you might as well show people what happens to murderers. That's the best way to maximize the deterrent. Some questioned that, saying that it could have the opposite effect, that the spectacle is brutalizing for anybody who witnesses it, that some people are likely to feel shame or even begin to feel sorry for the prisoner. But there were public executions for a long time. It was not until 1830 in New York that some executions were withheld from public view. And the last public execution was not so long ago. It was in 1936 in Kentucky. There was a hanging of a black man, which 20,000 people attended. And the next year, a white man was executed in 1937 in Mississippi. And the people who saw that one, many of those present who could afford the admission price, by the way, took away a souvenir piece of rope that was used in the hanging. Fifth, quote, humanizing the methods of execution. We can be comforted by the fact that in this country we have never had death by boiling, in oil, crucifixion, burying alive, or sawing in half, as some other countries have had. But as late as the 18th century in England and in America, occasionally criminals were pressed to death, drawn and quartered, or burned at the stake. But really the only acceptable method of execution in this country has been hanging. The first prisoner was executed, electrocuted in 1890, and then in the early 1900s, some states installed gas chambers. Gary Gilmore, who you probably all remember, 1977, was executed by firing squad, and now lethal injections are also legal in some places. And opponents to death penalty now are afraid that lethal injections that are already legal in, I think, at least five states, I'm not sure how many more. It's a couple years old, my information on that. But people are afraid that lethal injections might quickly spread, making the death penalty more palatable to judges and juries. It's supposedly the first, quote, humane method of execution, although you might remember when Charles Brooks was executed, it took more than 7 minutes for him to die. So some people are, especially in the medical community, are debating whether that is actually more humane than other ways of executing people. Sixth, experimenting with abolition. In the mid-1800s, there were many organizations that were opposed to capital punishment, and by 1850, some states, as a result, began abolishing the death penalty and substituting life imprisonment instead. Now, more states did that in the early 1900s, but most restored it then during the great crime wave of the 1920s and during the Depression. There were a lot of states that went back then to establishing the death penalty. There really wasn't another abolition movement until the late 50s and 60s, but in 1969, around there, because of Vietnam and also because of increasing crime rate, urban unrest, etc., there weren't many repeals of the death penalty. And that's when the whole struggle moved to the courts. But the decisions that were rendered, even in 1972 and 1976, said that the country was not quite ready for total abolition of the death penalty. What they did is decided that certain statutes were unconstitutional, but the death penalty per se is not unconstitutional. While some states abolished it, like my own state, Minnesota, in 1911, and never reenacted it, there are other states like Washington State that abolished it in 1913 and then reenacted it just 6 years later. I think the state most likely to reinstate it now is Oregon. Are there any Oregonians here? I know there have been bills in their house or legislature for the past couple of years, but they don't have it as yet, right? Okay. One interesting note, the states that have tried abolition, who have abolished the death penalty, there have been three consistent factors after abolition. First of all, there has been no remarkable rise in homicides compared with their death penalty state neighbors. Secondly, there was no greater problem with homicide in prison or with convicted murders after they were released. And thirdly, the lives of law enforcement officers were not at greater risk. That's true in all the states that have abolished the death penalty as compared to their neighbors who still have death penalty statutes. Seventh, reducing the number of executions. I should probably hand these out. I don't have enough for everybody, so if you want to, every two or three can take a look at some. I have some statistics written on these sheets, but in the 1970s, due largely to Supreme Court decisions and also to the work of the NAACP, there was a de facto moratorium on executions, and yet for about 10 years there were no executions, even though executions were legal. The decline had started earlier, and if you want to look on the back of your sheet, you'll see that in the 1940s, the decline started. The record high was about 200 executions in 1935. That's about 3 to 4 every week, but then it dropped steadily after that. The moratorium on, do people have them in the back? Somebody might want to, if you finish looking at them, pass one to the back if people haven't seen them. Moratorium, of course, is over now with, as I said, about 1,400 people under the death sentence in many states. One execution in 77, two in 79, again, one in 81, a couple in 82, five in 1983, 21 of them in last year, and already you can update your list if you'd like. There have been nine executions since that last date. This was prepared back in March. There have been 15 executions this year in the United States. So we're ahead of last year's. You might be interested also in knowing what is happening in other countries, particularly industrialized nations. The only industrialized nations that are still executing regularly would be Japan, the Soviet Union, and South Africa, where 138 people were executed in 1978 alone. I don't have any more recent figures for South Africa. There have been sporadic executions in Pakistan, Taiwan, Saudi Arabia, and a few countries in Africa and Latin America. By the way, excluding Nicaragua, for those who are wondering, right after the revolution, the first thing that Nicaragua did was abolish the death penalty. Many, many executions in Iran, but for most of the world, capital punishment has ended, including England, Canada, Scandinavia, and practically all of Western Europe. So the question again is why is it still here? I've told you that there is popular support for the death penalty, and that is rising, but I haven't talked about the reasons for that, and I will give you just a summary of some of the things I've read and then maybe open it up for some discussion. In a recent study done with a sampling of people from the state of Virginia, it seems that the reason that people support the death penalty is because the public is willing to impose the death penalty. They believe it's morally just and that it serves a useful purpose. Another report says that support comes as a response to widespread reports of relatively large increases in the official crime rate. But in one of the studies that's on the back of your sheet, you'll also see in a Washington Post poll, it indicates that deterrence was less often a reason given for favoring the death penalty than just plain revenge. It seems to be a reason that many people give for the death penalty. Time magazine quotes William Bailey, a sociologist from Cleveland State University, who says, "People are frightened and upset about crime in the streets. Nothing seems to be done to solve the problem, so the feeling grows that if we can't cure murderers, something we can do is kill them." Jim Jablonski, 44, a Chicago steel worker, speaks for a lot of furious citizens when he says, "Murderers got to pay. I say, fry the bastards." That was in Time magazine, and I want to say that all proponents of capital punishment put it quite that way, but it seems that the sentiment is much the same among the hundreds of people who regularly now vigil outside of prisons where executions are taking place. If you've read in the news now, most of the executions this year have had over 100 people demonstrating in support of capital punishment on the evenings or the days where people have been executed. There have also been counter-protests against the death penalty. The concern about the crime rate, by the way, is not unwarranted. I also have a few statistics on your sheet about the crime rate. It is not new either, but it came as part of our national consciousness around the 1968 convention, presidential convention, when law and order and crime in the streets became a political issue. I think it's, what are the statistics? Is it 11? What did I put down here? 11 people per 100,000 in 1980 was our crime rate. It has risen especially in the urban areas. If you're wondering what other countries are, I think England is 1.1 per 100,000. Japan is about 1 per 100,000. Those are the lowest in the industrialized countries. Some pro-death penalty people in part blame this jump in on the murder rate and the absence of executions during those same years. In other words, the years where there was a de facto moratorium, there were many more murders and other violent crimes. But many of those people also fail to believe criminologists who largely attribute that fact to during those years. It was the same years also when the World War II baby boom, children were passing through adolescence and young adulthood, and at the same time the number of young people rose. There also flourished the number of cheap, readily available handguns. So there are more than one or two reasons for the jump in the crime rate. And I think it's unfair to simply say that it's just those death penalty statutes. Okay, secondly, deterrence. The most widely used justification for the death penalty is deterrence. And it's also the most hotly debated controversy among people who are talking about the death penalty. The question is the death penalty an effective deterrent to crime? And I'm not going to go through all the studies. There are many of them, but I think you'll have to trust me to say out of all of them, virtually all of the research so far published on the deterrent effect of the death penalty is inconclusive. In other words, it has not been proven that it is an effective deterrent, and it has not been proven that it isn't. And that's where we stand on the studies done so far. At least the ones that have been presented to the Supreme Court and those done afterwards. They're just inconclusive so far as to the deterrent effect. I think it's important, too, to point out the flip side of the deterrence question. That should be shared. There is an opposing view. Some believe that the death penalty has an opposite effect of deterrence. In other words, that it brutalizes any society that uses it. This is what people call the doctrine of counter-deterrence, that the use of execution by government under law encourages people, either consciously or subconsciously, to imitate the same extreme methods because it institutionalizes revenge. And that we're to understand then some lawless acts of murder, especially lynching, as products of that kind of imitation and example. There are some studies that have supported this fact in different cities across the country over a number of years. The crime rate, the homicide rate, has jumped in cities where there have been public executions and even executions that were not public. The crime rate jumps in the next 9 months or so after there have been executions. So the argument has gone both ways on deterrence, and just want you to know both sides of that. Probably the most durable argument for deterrence in recent years is that the typical convicted murderer serves a prison term averaging about 80 months, nearly 7 years. And the vast majority of those not sentenced to death are eventually released, though many of them serve more than 7 years. There is a fear of these people committing the same crime again. So that is also a big fear among those who support the death penalty. Again, the flip side of that is that studies done so far have indicated one finds convicted murderers are quite unlikely to commit violent crimes again. In the first year, which is the most likely time for a murder to be committed again, it's something like 0.3% of those released ever commit another violent crime. I think it's 1% of all convicted murderers, when they're released, ever commit another violent crime. The last point that I want to talk about before opening it up is the fallibility of administering the death penalty, and this is another very hotly debated issue. The fallibility of administering the death penalty comes in a number of different areas. First of all, the possibility of executing the wrong person. Of course, that's rare, but it has happened. It's been proved that it's happened in a couple of different cases, that someone who was executed later on, they found that that person was innocent. But besides that problem, there are two other main directions of concern. The first is that capital punishment has been shown to be capricious, random, and irrational in its application. It happens to a very few people who are not necessarily the most dangerous, and selected by really no discernible principles or criteria from other convicted murderers. It's almost by chance that you become on death row or convicted for a capital crime. There's no discernible principles or criteria from among other convicted murderers or rapists or felons. Secondly, the death penalty mostly falls on poor offenders, members of the lowest social classes. For a decade, white and middle class offenders have been virtually immune to the death penalty. Very few women and very few middle class professional people ever face the death penalty. And the sort of the unwritten law is that if you have a good lawyer, you'll never get the death sentence. That's the reality if you talk to an attorney. And the last concern is that of the administration of the death penalty is that there's strong evidence of racial discrimination. Right? There is one study on your sheets, especially in the southern states where most of the executions are occurring. Black murderers have been executed much more frequently than white murderers. Right now, 2/3 of all death row inmates are black. And the new evidence today, I think it's very interesting, shows that it's not so much the race of the offender that matters, but it's the race of the victim. So whether you're black or white, if you kill a white, you're far more likely to get the death penalty than a person who kills a black. And it says a little bit about what we value in this country. I think at this point, I will stop my presentation and open up for questions, and then I'll direct it a little more if need be. Any questions right off the bat? About either statistics or maybe comments?
Yeah. I'll make one comment. Amnesty International is a large group, international group, that does not believe in the death penalty for the variety of reasons you've put down. It's capricious in its application, especially.
Yeah, Amnesty International is not only been working on torture and violence in other countries, but also the death penalty in this country. Not many people realize that.
If one were to try to answer the question strictly by the bio, excluding all other factors, what conclusion would it have to be? I know some people list as a reason for it, others list as a reason not. In your biblical research, which way would you have to go strictly on the bio?
Well, that one I will open up for other people to answer. But just to begin by saying that most of the vocal defense of the death penalty in the 19th century came from Christian clergymen. And that is no longer the case. Most of the mainline denominational churches have dropped their support for the death penalty. The exceptions being, I think, Jehovah's Witnesses, the Mormons, maybe some of the Baptists. But and it's not to say that all of them have come out strongly against the death penalty. But I'll open that up if people want to talk about biblical arguments, either for and against. One thing I was going to do is just erase this and have us list pros and cons, because I want to invite people to agree and disagree with each other. And for us to brainstorm on, you know, what are the advantages and disadvantages for our society to have death penalty statutes in force. And I'm not going to pretend to be unbiased, because I'm not. As a pacifist, I am against the death penalty, but I hope that I can invite both sides to share their opinions and questions, but we'll start with that one.
I think a pro is that it's a lot cheaper to execute people than to keep them in prison for long.
Okay. I'll put that on this side, but I also will share some information. There have been studies that have actually shown that the death penalty is actually more costly in many instances. Not that it's more expensive to kill an individual than to keep them in jail for life, but a criminal justice system in a state is cheaper if it's not burdened by the death penalty statutes because of all of the appeals and trials that one has to go through. 85 to 90% of all criminal cases are decided with a guilty plea and without ever having a formal trial. But in the case of the death penalty, a lot of states have mandatory trials and then mandatory appeals, and so the process goes on and on and on. It's quite expensive. In addition to the fact that, you know, you have death row, maximum security sections in prison. So, and actually in some states it's more expensive for them to have a death penalty statute on the books. So again, it's one of those statistics that I think we can put on both sides.
I think the way things are going, the laws will probably change to reduce the number of appeals that are possible. In California, one of the main reasons that Rose Byrd, our Supreme Court Chief Justice, is being attacked is her leniency on death row victims. That's one of the big issues that she's being attacked.
I think that's the movement right now, is to lighten up some of those restrictions and to speed up some of these trials. Again, the danger you run into is the possibility of making a mistake and executing someone who is innocent. And every time that you those appeal processes, that danger rises. But that is the movement.
Yeah, can you kind of explain this 80% that's in favor? What's the makeup of that? That sounds like an overwhelming majority.
Yeah, I mean it's most people. I mean I don't know. I don't know who it is.
Well,
yeah.
Is that 90% of the whites and 50% of the blacks? Or I mean, is there?
I've read it is it's lower. I don't know the exact statistics. It's lower among minorities. It's a higher percentage in the South. I had an article here that was specifically was in the Lutheran Standard and talked about ALC membership, and it's much lower obviously in states that don't have the death penalty statute, which are the five states that have the most ALC Lutherans. And so we're talking about now as we move into the new church, it's in North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Iowa. None of them have death penalty statutes, and those people are probably less in favor of death penalty statutes than people in some other places.
Is there a correlation between this rise back from the 60s to the state of liberalization of abortion?
That I don't know.
I mean, the mindset says it's no longer a sacred, dead life.
Dead life is not sacred. Yeah. I don't know. Does anyone have any comments on that?
I was going to comment on something else, so go ahead.
Okay, does anyone want to respond to that? Because I really don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question. I don't want to get into the abortion issue, but it would be interesting to see if there's any correlation.
Because we're talking about an attitude change.
Yeah, I mean, I see some connections definitely to the arms race, and that we see that I feel in our willingness to use the death penalty, we say that we really believe in violence to solve some of our problems. And I think that's certainly true in our defense policy as it's been moving the last years, and perhaps there's some correlation there. Go ahead.
I wanted to come back to the comment that was made over here and build on that a little bit. Comment on this, but my perception of part of what's going on right now is that there's a great deal of frustration with the legal system building among the populace. And part of what's happening is a reaction to that, the feeling that it's largely self-serving, that the population of lawyers is greatly increasing, and in order to generate business, they are doing things which are very self-serving. And I think the public is reacting against that. At least that's a feeling I have. And a part of what's going on here is a need to expedite, if you will, equitable punishment, this revenge thing that you're referring to. And I think a lot of what's happening is simply a reaction against that group mm-hmm. of people.
Okay. So how would I...
I may be wrong, but I'd invite comment on that.
Reaction against criminal justice system.
Exactly.
Anybody have any response to that?
Yeah, I've been swayed a bit by this, not from the standpoint of the lawyer angle, but more from the standpoint that the right of the criminal seems to be paramount to the right of the victim anymore. I get extremely frustrated when I hear that my tax dollar is going to pay for more books and more TVs and everything else in these prisons, and nothing seems to be going to the victim's family in a murder case, for instance. And I'm still searching for what is it going to take to get that thing flipped back around where it should be, mm-hmm. from my perspective.
Okay, and the connection then to death penalty would be what?
Well, the increasing frustration with the criminal justice system that seems to be focusing more on the rights of the criminal, that they are a person. Well, fine, they are a person, but they seem to have violated somebody else's rights in the process.
Okay. And the question would be, does the death penalty then give more attention to the victim?
Does that start to flip that focus back around and get it back to where I think it should be, in that let's quit patting the criminal in this case?
Mm-hmm. Comments? Questions?
Well, you know, my perception of the death penalty thing is that it's basically a bunch of lawyers that got together to try to create more jobs for themselves. They just want to make it a big deal, so have one more thing to be able to keep themselves employed, pay for employment. There's got to be a lot of money in death.
Well, it certainly involves a lot of legal, trials and... So that can be argued. Whether that's true or not, I don't have any evidence of what the motives are. But
well, there are more lawyers every day. You know, there's more and more of them going to school. So it's obviously a wonderful point for them to be employed.
I wonder if it's better to have a police officer to commit the execution at the time of the crime rather than have them look at the judge. And I disagree with that. But I think that... what you're saying is, don't have a justice system, and execute them right away. And I was wondering, in the statistics, is there any statistics on who was killed at the time of the crime, and is that related to execution? So can that be tied in with the statistics on execution?
I mean, what do you mean, who is killed?
Well, I mean, like, if you, a guy has a rifle and shooting people down the street, you go and you shoot them, that person. Is that considered to be an execution? Or is that not even considered?
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, if you start considering those types of things, then what happens to the number of executions?
Yeah, no, those are not counted in these figures, the figures that I've handed out. These are...
That happens quite often.
Yeah. Executions after.
And if you don't have a confidence in your justice system, maybe that's the way to happen. It's cheap.
Mm-hmm. Here.
Well, I took a course in, a short course in psychology, and they brought out the Jukes and the Kuleps or something like that. They propagated more criminals than you would believe.
And who were they?
This.
You want to explain here, for people? I'm not sure everyone knows what you're referring to.
Well, let me finish. Okay. I'll finish my statement then. And what I'm thinking is that these people are, the murderers are propagating the species. And you look at the list here, you look at that as a business person. In 1930, they had 155 executions, that many murders evidently. And then you get way down here to, so there must be a decrease.
This shows, this is a list of the executions, not of the actual murders.
Yeah.
There would be little correlation
but
between.
But my feeling is that when you execute a person, he's not going to be a repeater, certainly, and he's not going to propagate the species. And so that is, it does happen. I worked for the death penalty in Washington State, and it was, usually when I come out for something I lost. But it was reinstated recently. And one of the first things that criminals ask when they come to they're arrested in Washington State is, do you have the death penalty? So it evidently has some effect on those people. And as far as blacks are concerned, we just recently had this fellow stabbed a policeman, and the fellow doing it was black. And they held a tremendous investigation over this. Now, if he had been white, they would never have held an investigation over this. And I, in working for the death penalty, if you were interested, I have a quote from the Bible that I will send to you. And you might read it for the rest of your people that come here.
Are there responses or questions? Yeah, back there.
It seems to me that when you get to the death penalty, you're at the wrong end of the spectrum that what needs to be addressed is the violence and how that gets perpetrated over and over and over again. In our society, that we need prevention way back before it gets started. I mean, by the time you get to the death penalty, it seems to me it's too late. And the violence needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. In our homes and in our neighborhoods, against children who are being sexually abused, women who are being raped, and boys who are being raped. That whole cycle of violence needs to be addressed long before you get to the death penalty. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think one point to make is whether or not there can be prove that there's a deterrent effect in the death penalty. I think one problem with the death penalty, in my mind, is that it gives the appearance of actually doing something about violent crime without really touching any of the social structures or relations that really have something to do with violent crime. And we're not very good at going back to those causes in the first place. Why is our crime rate so high, and are there other reasons besides the fact that there have not been executions?
Is this the main argument for or against the death penalty, and that is the deterrent effect, or is it a moral question of some sort?
Well, I think it's been both. I think the Supreme Court has said that we cannot prove that there is a deterrent effect, and so that's, I obviously people have different opinions about that, but studies that have been done haven't shown that that's been the case. It can't be proved to be helping the criminal justice system at this point, or law enforcement. So then we move to other kinds of arguments, retribution or moral arguments or what it does to our society, and that's kind of why I want to.
But there are, how many things are there that you can prove? There really aren't many things that you can prove.
That's
true. So if that's the criteria, then we're really at a standstill. We don't have a solution.
Well, what I'd like to get is your own attitudes and opinions, because I'm not sure we're going to be able to prove here what's more effective in terms of law enforcement. So I really want to get at sort of what your feelings are, and perhaps I think it's more than appropriate gathered in Christian community here at Holland Village to talk. I mean, we haven't gotten to the biblical issues at all, and talk about how our faith might inform our views about the death penalty. It's something that we've avoided so far, but I'm wondering if anyone wants to comment in that vein. Yeah.
Is there any data? There was an inference here that by returning these individuals to society that we're propagating the species. There is some data in regards to some kinds of things like alcoholism and so on, that people who have alcoholic parents, there's pretty substantive evidence, even when they're taken at a very early age and placed in another environment, that they too become alcoholics more frequently than those who are not. Is there any data to suggest that in regards to violent crimes such as murder?
That I'm not sure about. I don't know, does anyone have anything to add about
that? The answer to that one is no. One other statistical quibble here, Tom, too, that there aren't any data on that. Because murder is a one-shot deal, it is not a behavior that you can measure over time. I'm speaking as a social scientist here. That one is really hard to measure. The other little quibble, Tom, is that you move as if they were synonyms from the homicide rate to the crime rate.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
And that's really not accurate.
Okay.
The homicide rate, in fact, is the only part of the crime rate that we know about. All the other crime statistics are totally up for grabs, right? Nobody knows what's accurate. The FBI statistics have been torn apart time and again. They're just worthless. They're absolutely worthless.
You can't even say the homicides are accurate.
They're closer, right? You can count bodies.
Because you really don't know for sure which ones are homicides.
That's right. There's some question about it, but it's closer than any other category of crime, right, to what we actually know about. So there is even less we're sure about than you were indicating, Tom, and I thought you were doing a terrific job of indicating how little we're sure about from this area.
Yeah. Okay.
So one of the questions is, should we kill people, execute people, when we're not sure about anything?
Okay.
There's a large state prison where I live in Michigan, and the warden of the prison is a member of the church I attend. And I've heard this warden say that if the death penalty is reinstated in Michigan, that's when he would resign from the criminal justice, from a criminal justice job, because having prisoners on death row is such an impossible situation that it produces such despair among the people who are in prison. So I think, aside from the moral questions, it's interesting to take this opinion from an expert in the field that this is damaging to the criminal justice system just to have these prisoners in his prison.
Yeah. I would say, in the things that I've read, is that many wardens and people in the prison system have been opposed to the death penalty, while many law enforcement officers have tended to be on the other side. And again, that's not, can't broadly generalize where they are, but that's, at least in my reading, that's tended to be the case, that wardens and prison officials have been opposed to death penalty, while some law enforcement officers have seemed to think that it would be better to have it on the courts.
Would you say that's easily understood, and that makes their job easier if they don't have this problem of death row?
Oh yeah, I mean I think what she's saying is that it's a burden on the prison system to have a death row.
I'd like to respond to that comment. It may make the job easier. It also has to do, I think, with relating to people as human beings. And that when you relate to people who committed violent crimes, I mean, the crime is heinous, and there's no way to justify the crime. But if you work with the people over an extended period of time, they too become people. And it is difficult for me. I work in a state mental hospital where we have medium security unit for people who have committed these kinds of crimes. It's hard, very hard to write these people off as having no value and as being unrehabilitatable and as having no more, I mean, it doesn't make it right for me to kill them because they were involved in a violent crime. And part of the problem of working with them in a long, if you would call it a problem, of working with them on a long-term basis is that you relate to them as people. That doesn't right their crime, but it puts it in a different context.
If we could, we only have a few minutes left, can we stay on that vein and talk about our, let's say, Christian responsibility in terms of treating people humanly and, we don't know what the crime rate's doing, we don't know what is a deterrent effect, but if we really want to say that the killing of a human being is wrong and ought to be condemned, what do we do and still treat people as human beings? Is there something in our Christian faith that informs how we proceed? We have not, I think it's very interesting that we have not generally talked out of the basis of our Christian faith. At least I haven't heard a lot of people at least mention Jesus or the New Testament or I don't know the scripture reference you're referring to, but I'm wondering if there's something in our faith that informs how we might deal with some of these problems. You want to elaborate, or? Yeah, I know what you're referring to.
That's all.
I believe that we believe people are redeemable. That that God can do miracles in people's lives, and I would like to see Christian people as a yeast in our society to provide countless more counselors and people to work in prisons with the people who are already there. I'm not even talking about getting at the causes of crime. But people are redeemable. God can do miracles with the worst person.
Okay. Thank you.
I think in response to your statement regarding scriptural, I don't really come at it necessarily from a specific text or whatever. I work in the juvenile justice system here in the state of Washington, and one of the things that I'm very aware of is the connection. Someone was talking about statistics. Is the connection between juveniles who are involved in violent crime and their own victimization, either by child abuse or child sexual abuse, a high correlation between that. And I guess where I'm coming from with the whole issue of, and how I don't ultimately even get up to the issue of the death penalty, because to me our society places so much at the wrong end of the street in terms of these kinds of issues, that we are a violent society, and for us to blind ourselves to that and just look at the other end, well, what happens when children grow up and become violent and kill people, and then we in turn kill them, that we're putting our emphasis on that end as opposed to the fact that the children are being victimized and children are being ongoingly abused. And yes, when they are abused and they grow up with the viewpoint of a violent world, they learn to live in a violent world and they become violent. And I guess an analogy to that to me is that as a culture, we spend more money patching our roads than we do patching our children. It's probably the wrong context. To me, that's where this issue ultimately floats down to, and I'm in opposition to it. I feel that it presents at a core the wrong attitude that we as a culture and as a society need to be presenting to our children, if nothing else.
But you need a solution when it gets to that point, though, don't you?
And how does our Christian faith inform our solution? I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. A couple more, I'm sure we have time for it later.
I'm getting off the subject a little bit, because I'm not going to take a Christian perspective, but it kind of bothers me a little bit when people keep talking about the humanness of the criminal. I understand that person is human. Take, for instance, the person in California who has driven on his country, and he did not take into consideration. So if we're
real hard sometimes to balance out the humans of that family when he or she did not consider that person a human when created by him.
And that's, it really does get tough because I think we're dealing with a gospel that elevates the life and the privilege of that enemy and perhaps lowers our own value as individuals. I mean, we're called to love those people who do us in. And it gets real hard when you see the kind of violence that people are capable of. But I think our own tendency is to always locate that violence outside of ourselves somehow and never recognize ourselves as someone else's enemies. I'm doing a lead-in to tomorrow morning's session, How Do We Love Our Enemies in the Nuclear Age? I'll be talking more about the war-peace issue, but it's on the same vein. I will be here for a while if people want to stay, but please feel free to go now. And we'll continue the conversation if people want to stay around in 8 seconds.